certainly a pleasure to be here this evening. We've had a lot of discussion
since Sunday morning at the Bible class time, and we have looked at a number of lessons. And tonight we're going to kind of wrap all of that up and bring everything back together to some point. Now, I want to thank again Joel for his selection of songs. The songs go with the lessons that I've been bringing. And I want to thank Dennis and Vicki and you good folks here for inviting us to come. Margie enjoyed her Ladies' Day. I know that you enjoyed, those of you that were here, to hear her on Saturday. And it's been a pleasure for me to bring this information to you. Now, we could talk about biblical archaeology and how it illuminates the Bible from now all the way through Christmas and beyond, but we won't be able to do that. So we're just touching the hem of the garment, if you please, in these last few days. There is so much material. Now, tonight, what I want to do is thank Dennis. You got a good preacher here, folks. You got a good preacher's wife. They're dedicated to the Lord. We spent 32 years in Charleston, South Carolina, before we moved to Montgomery, Alabama, 21 years ago to work with Fulton University. And I retired from there about a year or so ago as dean of students and also working with adult recruitment and so forth. And Margie worked in the financial aid office. So we enjoy retirement. But we're about as busy now as we were when we were working. And that's fine, too. There's nothing wrong with that. Time goes by quickly. It really does. Over here on this front pew where Joel's sitting, I have some magazines that pertain to archaeology. From this end, you and I can understand them. As it progresses down, it gets more and more technical about different sites. So if you want to know more about archaeology, and you can subscribe to some of these, just come and get the addresses off of these, or I'll give you my email address and I'll point you in the right direction. Remember now, these are the artifacts we've already talked about, and these are the ones that we're going to discuss tonight. But before we get to 1 Samuel 6 and a few other things, let me quickly point out a few things for those of you that were not here the last day or so. And we do appreciate all of you that are visiting with us. We really do. We're glad that you're here. This is, of course, a shofar trumpet. Joel blew it last night. We won't ask him to get a big breath and blow it again tonight. We talked about, of course, Jericho and, of course, the seven priests that blew the trumpets. This is a mud brick, remember? We talked about it last night. The man that made it signed his name by dragging his index finger and second finger through the mud brick, made of course, mud, straw, and animal dung. This is only 8 pounds. It would have been larger out here. We found a wall at Bet Shemesh that we'll talk about tonight later on. And after they examined that wall for a few years, they threw the rest of the mud brick to the side and we could take home what we wanted. Remember what happened, of course, when the Hebrews were in Egypt. Pharaoh took away the straw, so they had a hard time making this mud brick. Of course, they lined the mold with straw so it'd fall out easier. This, of course, is a New Testament Roman first century tear glass bottle. Romans were working with glass, hadn't perfected it yet, and this looks like two test tubes put together. Of course, you remember what happened there. Folks following a funeral would cry into these. They'd pay the mourners to cry, to shed tears for the deceased. And, of course, wives would fill their tears with these when their husbands or boyfriends went off to some sort of Roman deployment or war or whatever. Came with a small handle that's broken off here, and they would hang it in their homes and say, "Sweetheart, while you've been gone, look at all the tear glass bottles I have filled with my tears." And then, of course, someone says, "Yeah, probably an hour before you got home, they poured water in it." You know, there's always that case. This is a first century nail. This nail is the same type of nail. It's not round. The head is round like a roofing nail, but it has four sides, very distinct sides. And this is the type of nail that they would have used to nail the sign above the head of Jesus as he hung on the cross. This is a tablet, a cuneiform wedge writing here with we know for a fact it is Akkadian language. We don't know what alphabet they used, but this was given to me, and it dates 1,000 years prior to Abraham. It came much larger than that, of course. This is a pounding stone. It's flat on the bottom. This is what the ladies would have used to pound their grain. A New Testament lamp, a small one. Olive oil here, the wick in there, and it would burn. And this is an Old Testament lamp, days of Joshua. This is where the wick would have been. Would have been olive oil inside. It would have been used. We discovered a whole lot of these, and I was able to keep this one, nicked it on this side. And so that is from the Old Testament. So a big change in evolution of lamps. This is simply a bilbil. It comes from Cyprus. It's very thin, and it shows you some of the trade that was taking place. It's found in Israel. You put olive oil in it and pour it, and it sounds like you pour out, you know, a Coca-Cola bottle, 2 liter, and it kind of burps a little bit. Well, that's the same thing this does. So archaeologists come up with some real good technical terms. So this is a bilbil. And, of course, these here are carob seeds from the story, of course, of the prodigal son. This is what he was eating when he was feeding the pigs and the hogs. Has a hard husk. It's very hard. And they grow on trees. Take as many as you want when you're over in Israel. And you shake it, and you can hear the seeds inside, and they're related to chocolate. But it's very bitter. This is the jawbone of a donkey, the lower part of the jawbone. The rest of it would have been hinged up here. Of course, Samson used this to kill 1,000 Philistines, one similar to that. David fought Goliath. He would have put with a sling, probably larger than this. The little Palestinian boys make these over there. And on my 6 trips over since 2005, they would sell these on the streets. And so I bought one of those. And David would have put a sling stone or in there, 5 smooth stones that he got from the Valley of Elah, about the size of a baseball. Showed you some pictures last night and the other day about that. And he slung that to old Goliath, hit him in the head. They probably stood about 30 to 40 yards apart because they could talk to each other. And it was going almost 200 miles an hour, they suspect. Of course, God's working in that situation, and it dropped Goliath. Now, why did he choose 5 smooth stones? He only needed one. God was working with him. We can only assume that maybe he was going to have to use some more. I don't know. But if you read further in the Bible, you'll see that Goliath had 4 brothers. And I don't know if they were there or not, but in case they came forward, he'd have another stone for them as well. Frankincense and myrrh, spoken about in the Bible. Good fragrances and so forth. These are spices that would have been used to put in the folds of the cloth when Lazarus was buried, the same way Jesus was buried. They wrapped the cloth up around their arms, down to their sides, in a separate napkin cloth, as John 1st chapter 20, chapter 20, beginning in verse 1 tells us, and they put it on his head, wrapped that around his head. Nard, spike nard. Remember the story about that last night? That's exactly what Mary used to wash and anoint the feet of Jesus and wash his feet with her hair. And nard comes from India, and it is still it's expensive, over $10 for just a little bottle like this in the old city of Jerusalem. And, of course, that's the reason Judas made such a fuss, because it was so expensive. He said we could use that for other things. Why waste it on the feet of Jesus? But Jesus said, leave her alone. She's doing a good thing. Now here, I'll explain this very quickly. You'll see some of these in the slides tonight as we talk. Philistines painted their pottery, and that's what these little pieces here are. Couldn't bring any big pieces back because they keep those at the University of Tel Aviv to put things together. You'll see that later on. But Philistines, Canaanites, painted their pottery. Egyptians obviously did too. The Israelites did not paint their pottery. You can tell that by any of the pottery that you find in Israel's in Israelite strata. This is a realm, part of a Israelite bowl that would have been used, but it wasn't fired correctly, and of course it broke. This is the bottom end of a storage jar. Found this the last week I left on my first trip over. Found only thing I hit was this. I didn't know what I had. So this is in the ground, laying there, and it's been in the ground for 3,000 years. And you're the first one to see it in over 3,000 years. So I start out here, and you excavate in because you don't know what you've got. So I find this thing, and I say, what in the world is it? Of course, I get a quick education from Dr. Manor, retired from Harding University in Bible and Archaeology, and other PhDs that are there, and I find out this is a 4-foot storage jar. It had been turned inside. You can see where the fella turned it on a wheel, as well as the handle that would have went on the side of it. It's been turned as well. These big handles, we find lots of these over there. Find a number of these. They kept this one, and about a little over a month later, I received this. They sent it to Fulton University, and that's how I was able to keep it. They took it to University of Tel Aviv, to the lab that you'll see in a little bit, and they examined it. Now, when you discover anything over there, especially something like this, you have to ask yourself some questions. Okay, this is Israelite, yes, because I found it in Israelite strata. I'm not digging in the Egyptian. I'm not digging in the Canaanite or anything. I'm digging in the Israelite part of Bet Shemesh. Remember, Bet means house, Shemesh means sun, 12 miles south and a little west of Jerusalem, and that's where we have the reference of 1 Samuel 6 tonight. So I have to ask myself the question. All right, I find this. It's Israelite. I have to ask myself another question. Who is in Jerusalem as king at this time? King David is there. King David is in 1 Samuel 6 there that we'll notice shortly. So he's there in Jerusalem as king, sitting on the throne. So you ask yourself another question. The fellow that made this, he's only 12 miles from Jerusalem, King David. Did he see King David? We have no idea. Maybe that'll be answered someday. Storage jar, not liquid in here, because if it had been liquid, it would have been seared inside or burnished. And so this would have held, of course, grain. So that's the bottom end of a 4-foot storage jar. Here is a flint knife. This is the same type of flint, still has a little edge that the Joshua would have used, and his people to circumcise the males before they entered into the promised land. This, you'll see a picture of this up there tonight. This is an Osteria head, the face, the top part of a Canaanite goddess. God says, destroy these things. And when they destroyed them, 9 times out of 10, they cut the heads off of these things when they came through, and they didn't bother with the rest of the body. Usually they just cut the heads off. And these are found throughout Israel. I didn't find this at Bet Shemesh, though. This was bought through the Israeli Antiquities Authority. Beaded headdress, almond eyes, bulging cheeks, very distinctive that you'll see tonight. Here is a little widow's mite right here. Widow's mite. Had to pay $15 for 3 of them over there in downtown Jerusalem at the Israeli Antiquities Authority. This is a widow's mite. This is a juglet. Would have held olive oil. Came much larger, big jugs. And, of course, they would have used olive oil for their skin and also for cooking purposes. Found that at Bet Shemesh. This, ladies, is a perfume jar. Has 2 little short handles with holes in them so they could put some string across, maybe some twine, to hold it, and then they had to dip it over, and it would have held a perfume, maybe frankincense or myrrh or whatever that they would have used. I have some lentil, and I have some barley here in these little capsules. We found, the last trip I made in 2016, found a lot of these big storage jars over there. This one wasn't fired correctly. You can tell by the edge of it. And have big jars, and they were filled with either lentil or barley. So everybody wanted a little bit of that 3,000-year-old lentil or barley. So we used the old, had a bunch of these little capsules that you would put film in, and that's what we brought them home. And lastly, this is a murex shell. These little shells are all over the Aegean Sea along the coast. You can collect these along the coast. They attach themselves to the rocks, and what they would do, of course, this is Old Testament and New Testament, really. A lot of it, of course, it's both sides. But they would bore a hole in these little murex shells, and they would get just a few drops of purple dye out of it. Lydia was a seller of purple. It was expensive. A few drops of purple dye would take over 800 of these just to make a decent garment. Thyatira, where she was from, was the center in the first century of the industry of purple dye. And so that's where your purple dye came from back in those days. Of course, it's a lot different in this day and time. Now, let's go to the slides. 1 Samuel 6, we'll get to in a minute, but I want to show you a couple of things in review that I wanted to show you that we talked about that I did not show you the other day. This is the Jordan River. This picture was taken about 2010 when I was over there, and this is kind of what the Jordan River looks like. It's, in some places, not much wider than this aisle. It's a lot different than it was in the days of Christ. Of course, the Dead Sea has dried up. You drive along Highway 90, you look on the rocks on the left side as you're headed north. They've got marks up there where the Dead Sea was in 1901, and then in the 30s, and now the Dead Sea is across the highway over there on the other side. So the Dead Sea is literally drying up because they have dammed off, of course, the Jordan River that flows into it and so forth and so on. We talked about that the other night. Remember the other day I talked to you about the Canaanites, how they buried their children under their floors of their house? Well, that was part of their culture. This is a Canaanite infant burial jar. This came from Ai. Remember after Joshua came into the land, destroyed Jericho. We talked about the rehab of Rahab last night quite a bit. And we had, back in 2017, Dr. Stripling, who excavated for over 20 years at Ai, had sent over 70 artifacts over to the United States. They've been traveling different universities. We acquired them for a year, put them in the Furman Curley Library there at Fulton University upstairs in the Bible building, and made a big display of it, and we had it for a year. This was just one of the items that was there. They would put the infant inside there. They had some other pictures. Of course, an animal would come and eat the flesh, and then they also had the picture of the bones that were on the outside in the ground of this storage, of this infant burial jar. Canaanite infant burial jar. See the handle? Similar to this handle up here. Remember the other night, this is in 2006, first time I went over, went to Caesarea. We could talk a lot about Caesarea. This is a stone, a replica. Now, remember, a lot of secular archaeologists, whenever they dig, they don't dig with the Bible in one hand and the digging tools in the other. They just use the digging tools. But Dr. Mazar and some others over there now, and for many years, some have dug with the Bible in one hand and a petition in the other, because they believe the Bible. Not New Testament Christians, but they go along with the Bible. Well, this has the name of Pilate. The only name that's ever been discovered in the Middle East with Pilate's name on it. And a lot of archaeologists said, we don't believe in Pilate. Don't believe he existed. Well, when they found this at Caesarea, they changed their mind. So this is a replica. The real one is in the museum in Istanbul, Turkey. It says, Pilate was the Roman prefect who presided over the trial of Jesus in Nazareth, Matthew 27, 11 through 26. The contents of the inscription and the use of the Latin language hit at the level of how all of this Romanization throughout the province had taken place and in Caesarea at the beginning of the first century. You go downtown Jerusalem, old city, not the modern city, but the old city of Jerusalem. And this is just one scene of what you'll see. Vendors on both sides, elbow to elbow, very narrow. When we first went over, this is when you first go in. You go in, when we went into the Jaffa Gate, you go in. You can exchange your money there if you want to. Make a left-hand turn, and then you make a right-hand turn, and it's straight down through there, and then it branches off. This is what you see. Vendors on both sides, very loud, and everybody shouting back and forth, come and buy my fruit, come and buy my garment, da-da-da-da-da. And a lot of them are obviously related. Dale said, y'all step to the side. We did. Stand here. There were about seven or eight of us at the time when Dr. Manor took us there. Close your eyes. So we closed our eyes and said, just listen. And it was on, and the noise is louder and louder and louder. And all these merchants are shouting. He says, this is exactly what Jesus heard when he came to the old city of Jerusalem. This is exactly what he heard when he came into Jerusalem. Modern city wasn't there, of course. And that's exactly what he heard. It's exactly what we heard. And so if you ever go, stand to the side, close your eyes, and just listen for a moment. It's all in Aramaic and, of course, modern Hebrew. This is one of the retired counselors at Fulton University that went with us over there. Several professors, of course, went with us. I took a few students with me when I went. This is a stone. It may look familiar to some of you, but it's a wine press, and it's in the old city of Jerusalem. Kind of let you see what it is. Now, at Beth Shemesh, we find 5 wine presses. Made a lot of wine and so forth in Israel. So that's what it would look like. Notice what she's wearing. When you go to Jerusalem, ladies have to cover their shoulders and their knees and below have to be covered. Because you'll go to some of their holy sites and they won't let you in unless the ladies are covered because of respect. And so you have to dress appropriately. When you go to Jerusalem, especially the ladies, well, even some of the men, you go and dress as plainly as you can. You don't want to draw attention to you. They know you're a tourist. But all this expensive, these earrings and the jewelry and the bracelets, you can leave those at home. Don't even take them with you. This next end of May, 1st of June, in about a year from now, Marge and I are making plans to take our 2 children and our grandchildren over to Jerusalem and to Israel. Now, we won't be able to take them to just 10-day tour, won't be able to go into Jordan. We've been to Jordan, down to Petra, Madaba, Mount Nebo, so forth and so on. Been to southern Egypt. But we're going to go just to Israel, and we're going to travel for those 10 days. They'll lose about, Margie came over after the dig in 2010. She lost 8 pounds. Now, when I go, I stay for 30 days, the full length of the dig, and I work from, get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and work to, from 5 to 1, and of course I lose 30 pounds and grow a beard. Nobody knows me when I come home. Literally, Marge had to look twice. Grandkids didn't know who I was. My mother said, my goodness, when she was alive, she said, that sounds fine. You should have stayed 6 months. Anyway, all right. Remember we talked about the Dome of the Rock? That's not real gold, by the way. We talked about it the other night. That's the Muslim site. That's the Zion, many people believe. Archaeologists believe this is where Solomon had his threshing floor underneath that Dome of the Rock. Jews were allowed up there a few times a year. A lot of violence has taken place up there. But I want you to notice something here. This is a retaining wall. This is the only thing remaining from Herod the Great. He died about 6 months or so, we believe, after Christ was born. Of course, he's one that tried to kill all, that did kill all the babies, but Jesus escaped that. With his parents. But anyway, this is the retaining wall of the old Second Temple. Not First Temple, but the Second Temple. And this is a Jewish library down here. This is a way you can walk up to that other side if it's open. But this is a big courtyard here. But what I want you to notice are these green, this greenery growing out of the Western Wall. It used to be called the Wailing Wall because the Jews, and they continue to wail there and cry and so forth. But this is called hyssop. Hyssop is in the Bible. It's in the New Testament. Hyssop grows on a stick about 5 feet. And remember what they did when Jesus was on the cross. They put a sop on there with some, what we would know as drugs, to try to kill his pain. And he refused it. But they put it on the end of a hyssop stick. And that's hyssop that's growing out of that wall. Let's move on. Okay, what do a queen, Egypt, the Philistines, Canaanites and the Israelites all have in common? Well, they all hung out at Beth Shemesh. Those are the 4 civilizations there at Beth Shemesh. When Joshua goes into the land, the Egyptians are there, the Canaanites are there, the Egyptians are ruling some areas. We believe that we have evidence, archaeology-wise, that an Egyptian woman, which is very unusual, was ruling the area, kind of like a governor of a province. The Philistines, that lay on the Philistine border, 1 Samuel 6, and other passages, the Canaanites were there, and of course, the Israelites came along. They all were there at Beth Shemesh. Tel Beth Shemesh. Tel simply means what? Mound or hill, because one civilization builds on top of another. And here you go, here's your map. There is Beth Shemesh, and this center part called the Shephelah, right there. That word is in the Old Testament a number of times. There's Beth Shemesh, and here you have Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, Ekron, and Gath, the 5 cities of the Philistines. And they were, of course, on the coastal side. Over here you have the Judean Hills. You have Hebron, where David had his throne for a while before he moved up here to Jerusalem. And then, of course, you have Gezer up here, the professor at Gezer, who is has explored the water system at Gezer, is now opened up an archaeology department at David Lipscomb University in Nashville and has a great archaeology department there at Lipscomb, David Lipscomb University. Of course, they have a new president like we have it now at Fulton University, one of our Christian institutions. And here you have those five cities of the Philistines. Here you have Azekah and Sokol. This is the Valley of Elah right here. So we're north of that. And here you have Timnah. This is the Succor Valley that you'll see in a little bit. This is where Samson found his first wife right there in Timnah. Lachish, we talked about it last night, where Sennacherib camped out, had destroyed 46 cities of Judah, and was about to march into Jerusalem and so forth. The Shephelah is the most fertile part of the country. That's where they grow a lot of things. It's not as humid as it is over here on the coast, over here in these Judean hills, but it is warm, believe me. It is warm. Okay, archaeology, a border community of Judah. This is Beth Shemesh. It's about seven. This is an older photograph, but it's 7 acres. This highway has been widened. This is part of the town. Beth Shemesh is one of the fastest growing towns in all of Israel. This is where Netanyahu, this is where he was born and raised, former prime minister. And here's where we have been digging since 1990, back in the early 20s, and then early 30s it was dug before, and then it lay dormant from 1933 to 1990 when two professors took it over. There's that map again, so you got your location where we are right here in the middle part of the country. Here's a picture of, as you're standing at the dig site, you have the total station that measures anything. Anytime you find an artifact, whatever kind of artifact you find, you leave it in the ground. Leave it in what they call the situ. Just leave it in the soil. Remember, archaeologists call it soil. They don't call it dirt. Because you're going to use that total station to locate it, and then you're going to put it on a computer because there's a lot of work. There's more than just digging. Because when you go back to the kibbutz, after 1 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, you got to wash your pottery, categorize it. They've got to take the total station, all that computer stuff, put it into a computer, and then keep records and so forth and so on. And they're required to write about the expedition. The two professors are, and also Dr. Manor. I have two volumes of books that are books about that thick. There's two volumes of them. They're quite heavy. From 1990 to 2000. From 2000 forward, they're haven't completed them yet, but we'll have those in the future. If you'll note, let me show this. If you'll notice up here on this is the Succor Valley. They grow all kinds of things there. The years that we were there, they mostly grew, of course, the, help me, Margie, what's the hummus, chickpeas. Grew chickpeas there, make hummus. You can buy hummus in your grocery store, so that's what they grew. Up here, you'll see this odd tree and the little separation. That's where you can go and visit, and we did. That's where they believe, we don't know, where Samson and his father are buried. Remember now, Samson roamed this area. Samson, this is Samson's area. He roamed the Succor Valley. There's another picture of that valley. Here you are looking up off to the left-hand side toward Timnah, and you can still see some of the modern buildings. And over here, we've got a kibbutz where we stayed in. And you can see the low rolling hills of the Shephelah. At the bottom, they have the Bedouin that stays there. He comes up there during the summertime, and he stays there with his family. His wife is covered from head to toe. You just see about this part of her face. She invited the girls down one day for lunch. He lives there, protects the dig site while we're gone, and during the nighttime and on the weekend. Because we work from Sunday through Friday, and we worship the Lord on Sunday afternoon about 4 o'clock underneath the shade tree. All the Christians gather. We have our communion, have our singing, have a little sermon, so forth and so on. But anyway, the Bedouin, and then when wintertime comes, he goes further south all the way to the end of down to Beersheba, down toward the end of what we now know as Israel. Here's a little drawing of Beth Shemesh. This is where we've been digging. This is where they dug over here in the 1900s in these areas. But here are the references in the Bible. The territorial border of Judah, the tribal allotment of Dan. It was a Levitical town. The return of the Ark of the Covenant, 1 Samuel 6. The Ark of the Covenant comes back. The Philistines and the Israelites had been fighting a war. Israelites lost. Philistines had the Ark. 1 Samuel 6 tells us, and I'm paraphrasing the story, of course, that what has happened is they have the Ark. And they're going to have to give it up because God's putting a lot of plagues on them. The Bible says they put tumors. God put tumors on them as well as some other plagues. Well, you convert that word in Hebrew, it simply means hemorrhoids. And those are painful. And so eventually what they do, they put the Ark of the Covenant on a wooden cart, put two milk cows, took their calves away, and let's put it on the road to Beth Shemesh and let's follow it. So all those five kings hid, those Philistine kings, and they watched it go down, and it landed, of course, in that field that you just saw. Some of the men touched it, and they died. Shortly after that, David's still on the throne in Jerusalem. He moves it up to the northwest part of Jerusalem. It's King Solomon's district. A battle took place there. Jehoash and, of course, Uzziah. Philistines captured, of course, Beth Shemesh in the days of Asa. So those are some references, and that's just exactly what I told you there. And the 14th year of King Hezekiah, King Sennacherib of Assyria came up against all the fortified cities. We had talked about that earlier over in 2 Chronicles. And Sennacherib goes back, and he displays his victory on his walls in Nineveh. Here's a picture of Sennacherib coming up, of course, from Assyria over here. He comes down and then he attacks all these towns, wants to go in, even Beth Shemesh and that mud brick. He burnt part of that. That was part of the wall. And of course, then he goes and tries to conquer Jerusalem, which he besieges it. He does not. We talked about Hezekiah the other night. There's a cistern there where they collect water there at Beth Shemesh as well as other places. The walls are plastered. And here's a picture of the water system. Very elaborate. They knew how to collect water. They knew how to keep it pure and clean. They did an excellent job. Wonderful engineers back then. A person down in there finding a jug, a little jug over here. And you'll see here in just a moment. At that time, Joshua spoke to the Lord in the day when the Lord gave the Amorites over to the sons of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel, sun stand still at Gibeon, and the moon in the valley of Ashkelon. And the sun stood still and the moon stopped until the nation took vengeance on their enemies. Remember that verse? You remember that battle? And God granted Joshua's request so that the battle could continue. Well, I was asked one day to go up to the top of the dig site and bring back the Joshua cloth. I had no idea what a Joshua cloth was. Got back and I gave it to some of the workers there. They took it and they stood up behind it and held it up so they could take pictures as if the sun stood still. They could take pictures of the dig site. This is an older picture here. Now they use a drone. This is an olive press recreation. So when you read in the Bible about their olive oils and everything, this is how they would have that made. And, of course, this is a burial site there at Beth Shemesh. And, of course, when you go in, you'll see this ledge. They'll lay the body there until the flesh rots away. Then they'll collect the stones, and then they'll gather them up. Similar to what Jesus did, but he arose from the dead. Remember, that tomb is empty upon which our faith is based. This is some 8th century pottery, days of Joshua. You'll notice that handle up here in the upper left-hand corner, it has a picture on it, and they would have Hezekiah would label his storage jars, and the handle would indicate that it belonged to the king. It's called a Lamelic handle. This is a patrician house, a house of wealth, with the items that were found there at Beth Shemesh, like gold. Gold has been found, not much, but some. There's a good picture of the storage jar and the handles that were on it. And you can see down here in the lower left, here's your Israeli lamp, Israelite lamp. This is Dr. Letterman and Dr. Shlomo. Dr. Shlomo died about a year and a half ago. He was one of the great pottery readers of all time in the Middle East. He would take a piece of pottery and he would look at it and he would examine it and he would tell you what it was. Then he'd show you a picture of it in an assembled jar or vase or whatever. And you can tell a lot about a culture, of course, with all of this pottery that has come out of Beth Shemesh. Here's more of that beautiful pottery is found in the reservoir. This, of course, is a chart because when you dig down, you begin up here at the Iron Age, all the way level 3, 4, you come down further to the bronze, and of course, then you'll see the middle bronze city wall there at Beth Shemesh. It's quite detailed. It's more than just digging. You dig slow, and it's very meticulous. Now, pig bones. Early Iron Age sites. You see those sites there are all Philistine sites. Pig bones have been found. No pig bones were found at Beth Shemesh because in the Israelite area because the Israelites did not eat pork. And then, of course, late Bronze Age sites, more of the pig bones that have been found in those sites. This is a young lady that is doing an articulation of a wall. She is dusting and pulling out the dirt, the soil, from in between those rocks so that when the picture is made, it is very distinctive. We did a lot of that while we were there, standing up and doing that. This is not Indiana Jones stuff, folks. This is nothing even close to old Indy at all. We have nothing to do with the Nazis like he did. And let me tell you, he didn't do a whole lot of digging either. But you do a lot there when you go on an excavation. Now, you and I like board games, and we play board games. Play Monopoly. Well, when you have Monopoly, you've got the little figures, right? Well, let me tell you what they did back then. They had the same thing. Over 3,000 years ago, right here is a game piece, and it says Hanan, H-A-N-A-N, in Hebrew on here. It dates to about the late 10th century B.C., still the days of the judges. And here are some ostracon, pieces of pottery with writing on it, about the 12th century. When you find any of this, like they did at Lachish especially, it'll tell you a lot about what's going on there. And when you read the Bible, you can read between the lines and kind of see it a little bit clearer. So there you have a game piece. And that game piece, of course, was found at Beth Shemesh. Well, I'm reminded of 1 Chronicles 27:28. Over the olive and sycamore trees, in the Shephelah was Bana Hanan, the Gederite, and over the stone stores of oil was Joash. Is that the same person? I don't know. But that name appeared on that game piece, and it's recorded with the same name in 1 Chronicles 27. Kind of interesting. This is a kind of a commercial area where they would find items there at Beth Shemesh of all sorts. This is, of course, Philistine pottery. I have a little bit of that up here. Now, here's your lamellic handle. It means belonging to the king. The king would stamp that, showing, don't touch these storage jars of mine because that's my stuff. That's exactly what it means. It belongs to the king. And so he had some of these in other areas, in case other areas of Israel, in case maybe there was a riot and he had to get out of Israel. Well, he'd have his storage jars and have his food waiting for him, but don't mess with it because it belongs to the king. That's the picture of it with that winged item on there belonging to the king. Now, when you find pieces of pottery, you got to take it back to the University of Tel Aviv and you got to put it together. Well, that looks like a lot of work to me. And that takes days and days and months and sometimes years because you've got to put Humpty Dumpty back together again because when you find it, 9 times out of 10, it's not intact. Dr. Bailey went over back in the early 80s to Jordan when he was at Drew University. Jordan, Drew University has a dig site they've been taking their students to for years, and he collected pieces of pottery like this, put it in a suitcase. He got back to Atlanta, and they opened a suitcase to make sure, you know, for security, and they apologized for breaking all of his pottery. He said, it was broke when I put it in there. Anyway, there's Dr. Shlomo, deceased, but he's putting together this storage jar. You see how it's narrowed down at the bottom? And the reason is because they would put these in ships and ship these things over to the Aegean area. And, of course, they would bury it in the ground. A little easier when it's in a cone shape. Well, he put this together. He's using masking tape. And then if he thinks, well, now this is exactly where it needs to be, then he would take the masking tape off, and he'd use Elmer's glue. Because then if it's still not right, he could still break it off and change it because of the Elmer's glue. He didn't use super glue. If he did that, it wouldn't come off. This is Dr. Letterman's daughter. Here's some storage jars again as they've been put back together. Beautiful, beautiful jars. Lamellic handle jar in a destructive layer here. You can see this big jar. That's how we found some of the lentils and other things there, over there in the barley in those jars. Wine set. Found that in the Israelite area. Strainer. Did the Israelites strain their wine? Philistines didn't. But apparently, with this wine set put back together, perhaps they strained their wine. Here's some earliest known iron workshop. The earliest known found in eastern in the Mediterranean area. This is, of course, at Bet Shemesh, and this is iron. Remember, the Israelites didn't work with iron. They didn't know how, but the Philistines did. And it lay on the border of the Philistines. Did they ask the Philistines, would you come over and sharpen some of the iron for us? Would you sharpen my axe or whatever? I don't know. But they had to have learned it from perhaps some of the Philistines. So the largest ironworking shop and one of the earliest is found there at Bet Shemesh. Here they are peeling the floor back as they continue to excavate. They're on their hands and knees and squatting. 06, I could do it pretty good. 2017, after trip number six, I had a hard time getting down and getting back up too and getting on your knees. But it's meticulous work. You have to break the soil up with a pickaxe about a half an inch or so and then get on your hands and knees and excavate. Like I said earlier the other day, archaeology creates more questions than it does answers. And this is one of them. This is the burial of a donkey found at Bet Shemesh in the Canaanite strata. Now, when you begin to study this, I've done some research on this. Canaanites sacrificed some donkeys in their work. There's a number of references to it in the Bible, in the Old Testament especially. This donkey had its back and neck broken. Now, you can see the lower part right here, this jaw that we have sitting on the table. This jaw came from south of Montgomery County from one of our farmers there that attends university congregation. But it's the same type here. So we don't know. It created a lot of questions at the time. Then you have to improvise. Of course, here, you know, when you start up here and look how far down we've come in almost 30 days. This is an older picture, but here they're trying to take a picture of some of this mud brick wall that's remaining, some of that mud brick there. Well, they've got a pole here with a PVC pipe on it, and there's a camera right there. And that old boy over here, I believe he has the string that will pull the trigger to take the picture. But we got better than this as time went on. This is a good sight. You'll see the patish laying here. I forgot to bring my patish tonight. Flat on one side for scraping a wall and pointed on the other for digging, and you're on your hands and knees, and you're side by side, and you're digging down in an area that's about 10 by 10. Can you see what's here? Jar handles, as they begin to appear. It's hard to see sometimes, even in person. Dr. Shlomo doing some pottery reading. He tells you about the pottery and what it looked like in the books that he has. another picture of horse Philistine pottery, an arrowhead, an iron arrowhead that was found, a bead that was found there in an area. You have to categorize these and then describe them in your documents. A crater belonged, this is a Philistine. Philistines built large bowls and had an indigenous bird on many of them and decorated their pottery. There's a drawing of it, and then what it really, of course, looks like after they've put it together. A chalice that's been found there, a Canaanite chalice from the Canaanite strata. Part of a crater. You can see some of the Philistine drawing over here on the side. You can see where they've put it back together some. This, Dr. Manner found this a number of years ago. This is Hebrew, has to do with a priest. So a lot of questions, a lot of questions. Jar handles, there's my petition, my initials on it, laying there kind of as a measuring for these jar handles that we find all over. Another jar handle in the center. Pottery laying here. Look at all of this. Now, that takes a while to extract from the ground. Buckets of soil that you've got to sift and put it in a wheelbarrow and then take it and dump it at the end of the dig site after you've sifted. Now they have a wet sift where they wet the material, because then you can find even small pieces like this little mite, which you wouldn't find there, a widow's mite necessarily, but you would find smaller pieces when they do a wet sift. Now here's a trowel. This must be a part of a brick here. They've labeled it, and then this an opening here, and here you've got a handle still on this vessel. Here's some of your seeds, if you would please. Actually, that's barley that they have found, bringing that out of that bucket. This is a found in 08. You have to tag everything, no matter what dig site you're at. This is a stone, obviously, and it's hollowed out so a pole would have set inside. Remember when I told you that at the exhibit there at Faulkner, they brought in a truck and everything was in crates? Well, they brought this crate that was humongous. It was a great big old crate. And they had to get it out of the van, put it on the elevator and take it upstairs. Well, when they got it up there to the library, how are you going to get this 1,500 plus pound stone out of this thing? Well, what I had to do, I just got a hold of five Faulkner football players, those big defensive linemen. Said, "Fellas, if you'll come up and help me move this thing, I'll buy you a hamburger." Well, they were there in no time, of course. So they just lifted it up. I said, "Sit it right here," and they did. And the same way when we got ready to pack it up a year later. It would have, in fact, that stone was the stone at the entrance of Ai. The entrance gate that the big post would have stood in and turned. They didn't put it in the ground because it'd dig its way down. They put it in this stone. Well, they got to bring some water up. Remember going to grandma's and using the well and the bucket and the dipper like we did in North Alabama years ago? Well, this is the way they did it. And it always didn't work sometimes because those handles, of course, would break off. A stopper that would have went into the end of a storage jar. Oh, an axe handle. An axe handle. Look at that. 3,000 plus years old and still sharp to a point on the end. Very interesting. Same thing David would use, but it's a little bit larger than a baseball. That is a sling stone. Here we have an interesting find. You can see some of it. It's the lower part of the body of a woman. This is the way it was found in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pieces. This, and here's a better picture of it. There you go. This is a drawing of it. This is what it looked like. It was found by a little girl from New York that was over there digging with us about as far from here to the table there. And she was in another square. This is an Egyptian woman. This is some of the evidence that we believe that Egyptian goddess, or not goddess, but governor, oversaw this area. She's holding two lotus leaves in her hand. She's got the Egyptian headdress, and the figure of a woman, and she is standing on something in the drawing, but notice it is not over here. So whoever made the drawing didn't do it correctly because there's no pedestal here. It's obvious that it's a woman, and it's unusual instead of a man. This is a cartouche that was found there at Beth Shemesh. This is paying homage, whoever made this, paying homage to the Pharaoh in Egypt when Joshua goes into the land. And we believe the Pharaoh was Amenhotep IV. That was the first, second, third, and fourth. And then the fourth, his real name was Amenhotep, but he went by Akhenaten. And so this is Egyptian hieroglyphics. I've studied some of it. I'm not an expert. I'm only an amateur at all of this. But that is paying tribute to the Pharaoh in Egypt. This is an Egyptian, how do I describe this? It's a small object made out of stone. And the Egyptians, of course, paid homage to the beetle. The little beetle, because it would roll its dung and with its hind legs and so forth, and that's what this is paying tribute to. So this pointing toward more Egyptian influence there at Beth Shemesh. And so the Egyptians thought, well, this little dung beetle is rolling its dung inside the ball of dung are its eggs. And so he'll roll that with his hind legs, and they'll always go from west to east until those eggs hatch. Well, the Egyptians thought, well, that symbolizes to them the sun going around the sky. A lot more to that, but that's basically where it is. Iron sickle blade discovered, part of a chalice. Oh, that's teeth from a cow that was discovered there at Beth Shemesh. More pottery. There's a good picture. You see the wheelbarrows here? Now you've got the sandbags on the wall, so if you walk, you don't break the wall down. A cover over it to help us stay a little cool. Obviously, it's got about break time, got the water bottles, and that's kind of what it looks like. It is not glamorous work at all. That's the reason I didn't shave. I wasn't going for a beauty contest at all. And there we have lots and lots of dust. And there we have more. There's Dr. Culberson from Hoover, Alabama. Dr. Wheeler, head of the Bible department at one of our Christian schools at York College in York, Nebraska. And here are some of the professors back here speaking. Here are the brushes you have to use to clean the floor so the pictures will be taken. More of all of that. This is Dr. Manner from Harding. Maybe you recognize him. And as they took pictures of it, back in the early days, but then of course they had young people to operate the drone that would take its own pictures. Wouldn't have to worry about it. Dr. Bubel from Lethbridge University in Canada always brought college students with her so that work could get done very quickly. I'll go through the rest of these very quickly. These are just pictures. This, by the way, is a huge bowl. The rest of it would have been inside this wall. Would have been a mixing bowl. I mean, that's a huge mixing bowl for the people that lived there at Beth Shemesh after they had excavated it. More of the excavation taking place. You can see this is how far this area here used to be the same height, but now they're down here. Didn't mess with this during that year. Have to compare the soil, the Munsell scale, that's Dr. Bubel. What kind of soil do you have? They sent some of this soil off. Found out there used to be a pig pen, not a pig pen, but a goat pen here. A lot of goat ingredients in that soil. Measuring all of that, looking at it. Standing there, scratching your head, what does that go to? What is all of this? There's that storage jar that you see here that they kept. There's a close-up of it. There's your Asteria head. God says, destroy these Canaanite goddesses. Fertility goddess, because of where they've placed their hands, of course, and they cut their heads off, and I have one of them up here for you to look. Now, as we draw to a close here, this is a Canaanite temple, worship area. I was able to excavate some of this. There are three stones you'll see here in a minute. There is a part of that stone that the others don't have. that has a groove in it that maybe would have, where some of the blood would have flowed out from it. As we begin to excavate, as Dr. Manor is standing on part of it, and as you continue to go down, 1, 2, 3, and then over here, I think I have a picture of an area where they brought the cattle in. There I am on my hands and knees, my patish. I don't have my knee pad because those old knees don't work as good as they used to. And I'm excavating there at the Canaanite temple. And this is where they probably would have led the cattle through as we excavated and as they're measuring and as he's got his hands on his head with a lot of questions, of course, and some of the pottery and things that we found. We found chalices there. Everything that we found there so far through 2016 and even in 17 when they finished it up was related to a temple there. There's part of a chalice that we're holding, and there's the other part of it. There's a handle with some Philistine writing on it. There's another one, storage jar, Philistine pottery, up close, Philistine handle, little beads, and I think, oh yeah, we found some, of course, Zuphoric vessels in the shape of animals here, except for this. This is a figurine similar to the one that was found earlier, that female. And then here's a storage, a perfume jar similar to the one that I have here. This was not found at Beth Shemesh. This was from Ai. But this belonged to the Egyptians. The Egyptians' ladies would darken their eyebrows and they would use soot. And that's exactly what would be on the end of that. There's your murex shell where they would bore the hole in there. This is a little, look at how small this is. What is this? Well, it shows here a man over here, and you have four legs, you got an animal here. Is this Samson and the lion? Someone made this. He was well known. You've got mosaic floors in northern part of Israel showing pictures of Samson as way they depicted it. It's called the little Samson or vessel that they found, very small. Another picture of it. There's the animal, and is that Samson on this cartouche standing on top of a lion that we found? He roamed the area. This is his part of his home, and here's a part of a bull that we found. Then, of course, as we close here, 2014, there's a pin, and there's the size of that little piece that we found. And when you roll it out on a piece of clay, you can see what it says through there. So, of course, the flint stone, a flint, and then there's a thumbprint of an individual that signed that particular handle. And then, of course, the part of a stone that still remains there, part of the roof of a house there. Reading the pottery back at the kibbutz, and a picture of the Mediterranean Sea with the sun setting, and that is the end. So, there's a lot of information in a quick period of time, but these items that we have here tonight kind of give you a little bit more of a vivid picture of what life in the culture was like in the Bible, whether it's Old Testament or New Testament. We don't need these to prove the Bible. We are like Rahab. We accept it by faith. And her faith was strong. Our faith needs to be strong as well. So, these things illuminate the Bible. These things, when you read about Rahab and the walls that fell outward that we talked about last night, when you read about 1 Samuel 6 and about the ark coming back to Beth Shemesh, this is the area. This is the place. And if you go to Israel, you can go by and visit these things. It's easy. Your driver's license is good in Israel, by the way. And you can just rent a car, and they drive on the same side of the road, thank goodness, that we drive on over here. And you can just go and come as you wish. You can go to the Red Sea, southern Israel. You can go to Masada. You can go up to Galilee. You can see they're in Galilee. When you go to Capernaum, where Jesus spent a lot of time, you'll see what remains of Peter's house. It's large because Peter was there with his wife and his mother-in-law James, John, Jesus, they were all there. It's a large house. And you'll see a Byzantine, what's left of a Byzantine synagogue, but underneath you'll see several feet of a first century synagogue because Jesus spoke at that synagogue, the Bible says, and then he walked about 30 yards to Peter's house. It's the same area. It's the same place on the Sea of Galilee. Go up there and see the Jesus boat. Hundreds and hundreds of places. And Israel is small, about the size of New Jersey. You can go from one side to the other in no time, north and south, in a day's drive easily. We've driven it a number of times. Israel is a great place, but the Bible is even greater. The Bible is a true Word of God. And that's exactly what we need to be focused on all of the time. I know this country's having problems like you know. We've got things going on that we don't like. But things have happened that we pray. And if we pray, that's what we need to continue to do. To pray for the church, to pray for His kingdom, to pray for this country, to pray for one another, and to uplift and encourage one another, and to pray for prospects of individuals that know not the true Christ in which we can teach. And I'll end with this. I want you to pray for Cuba. I've been there 6 times. Communist country. Been there on 6 trips, mission trips. It's only 90 miles off our coast. They have 5,000 Christians plus in Cuba right now. They have the largest church is in Matanzas, where we go, 90 miles from Havana. Havana has about 150 members. Matanzas has over 350. Not in a church building like this, in an open-air place. Tony Fernandez is the preacher there. His father started that congregation back in the 30s. I won't go into the details about how it began, and we can do that at another time, and how we got in the late 80s when Castro was in office, was in power. But I asked Tony, I said, Tony, I'm going back to the United States. When I get to come back, what do you want me to bring? What do you want? What do you all need over here? He looked me in the face and said, Ferris, the only thing we need is prayer. Just pray for us. We're under a communist regime. We have a good relationship with the government. We'll go into all of that and how that happened. But pray that we'll continue to preach the gospel and to increase this congregation and others in the area. We went out and visited in the province, rural areas. People that living in small shacks. Everybody has electricity in Cuba. They may have one light bulb, but that's all they've got. They're in poverty. The country is going downhill. They don't allow shortwave radios over there because they don't want the people to know what's going on in the rest of the world. A fellow took in a whole suitcase full of them. They arrested him, and he's still in jail as of 7 years ago. So brothers and sisters, pray for Cuba. Pray for those in the Ukraine. Pray for those all over the world. Pray for those that you're helping in your mission work, wherever they may be. Pray for one another. Pray for the congregations in this area. Because, brothers and sisters, there's power in prayer. Hezekiah found that out, as we talked about the other night. If you're not praying, shame on you. Publicly is one thing, but privately is another. There's power in prayer. You want to change the world? I want to change the world. I'll tell you how you can change it: by converting one person at a time, bringing one person to Christ. You know how, you know enough to become a Christian, and you know enough to teach someone else. I pray that you will. We're living in Montgomery, Alabama, where congregations are very prevalent. South Carolina has some 85, 90, last time I counted, congregations in the whole state. Lauderdale County, North Alabama, Florence area, where my parents grew up, where I'm from, 90 congregations in one county. Shows you what the Bible Belt is. Doesn't matter where you are. If you're overseas anywhere, if you're right here, pray for the Lord's work wherever you are. If you're wayward, if you need rehab just like Rahab did, if you need to change your life like she did, you need to come forward. Jesus is standing here with his arms outstretched, just like the prodigal son that we talked about the other night. And he wants you to come back to him, to your first love. If you haven't named him as your Savior, you're not guaranteed this moment, much less tomorrow. Make it right while you have that opportunity. Won't you come as together we stand and sing?